Committee. Today, we have four bills on our agenda, Senate Bill 61, Senate Bill 333, Senate Bill 763, Senate Bill 935. We will start with Senate Bill 763, and there are some folks that have signed up for 763, so we'll call that panel forward and the appropriate legislative revenue staff.
This vertical housing zones makes me nervous, Mr. Chair. This is going to be like a prolonged hype joke, is it?
I hope not.
Okay, good.
Morning, Senator.
Shorter housing.
Shorter, better housing. Lower the ceiling.
There could be some money in this, Senator.
That's what we do with school funding. We lower the ceiling. We might as well do it with houses.
Ma'am, please orient the committee to the contents of the bill.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with Senate Bill 763, we had a short hearing on this. Oh, I guess it was April 16th.
Short hearing, see it already.
Yeah, and we'll just go through some of the, what the bill does. Basically, it is allowing the Director of Economic and Community Development Department to create vertical housing development zones if they're requested by a city or county. And the vertical housing development zone shall be approved if they constitute a core area of an urban center, a light rail station, or as a transit-oriented area. You will file an application with the Economic and Community Development Department, and for each one of these various development projects, once a housing development project is occupied, the vertical housing development project shall be partially exempt from property taxation depending on the number of floors that there are of residential housing that the project provides. Now, you do have in here a dash 1, a dash 2, a dash 3, and a dash 4 amendment. So I've given you a quick summary of each one of those different amendments. And to begin with the dash 1 is adding to the specific statement of the legislation the purpose in Section 3, and it's specifying that cities and counties have a role in acquiring property for development in partnership with other private entities. And it's adding a new section which then is going to allow cities and counties within an established vertical housing development zone to acquire real property for development. And the governing body of the city or county has to agree that the development will encourage high-density residential housing or efficient use of mass transit facilities. So that's what the dash one is doing. It's just allowing cities and counties to acquire property for development. And with the dash two amendment, what that is doing is making some technical corrections to the existing bill, changing some ors to and of, and then it's also excluding special districts from providing this property tax exemption for vertical housing projects and vertical housing development zones. So that's what the dash two is. It's separating out special districts and saying special districts do not have to pay for this property tax exemption. They do not have to lose local government revenue. Now with the dash three amendment, this is again correcting some minor grammatical errors. It's also requiring a list of the taxing districts that impose taxes in the code areas in which the proposed vertical housing development projects is to be located, and to include this in the application process that the person who is requesting this property tax exemption has to submit to the Economic and Community Development Department. So this is just an additional thing that will be required by the developers wanting this property tax exemption. It's going to specify that each taxing district must receive information on that proposed vertical housing development project, and time will be given for comments so those local districts can participate in the process of establishing and approving these vertical housing development projects. The applicant must also verify that those local districts have been notified of that proposed project. So that's what the dash three is, adding additional language to the application process, making the local taxing districts more involved in receiving input. And then with the dash four amendment, Senator Beyer wanted to specify that the property tax exemption would be in the bill. We have a blank in section 10 on page 3. So we haven't specified yet how many years this property tax exemption would be for.
Can I put anything on gun control in that blank?
Let's look at the relating clause here. Oh, relating to vertical housing zones. So with the property tax exemption,
so you're trying to put schools in vertical housing.
No, we're not. That's this bill with schools, that's under fire.
So with the what Senator Byer, I think, wanted was a property tax exemption for 10 years.
Yeah.
And so, but I'm sorry to say, what the amendment did was make, it put 10 in the blank, and 10 was supposed, it really should have been a 9 in order to make this a 10-year exemption, and we now have a 11-year exemption. Just because of the way it was a little bit of miscommunication there with legislative counsel and myself on what exactly they needed in that blank. And that should be a 9 in the blank, but our amendment says a 10 is in there. So we've actually created a property tax exemption for 11 years instead of 10 years. But we can change that. It's just a minor change in that Dash-Gore amendment.
You can get it past Secretary Hall and the Senate.
Okay. As far as the revenue impact, I haven't run actual numbers. I think we'll be getting some testimony today kind of on what particular projects they're targeting with these vertical housing zones. Really, the revenue impact obviously depends on the number of these housing development zones that are allowed, how long those zones will be in existence, the number of years, then we know is now going to be 10 years for that partial property tax exemption, and the number and the size. I mean, this is a partial property tax exemption dependent on the number of floors of residential housing that you have on these various projects. So this is really going to change the revenue impact depending on the size of those projects that are approved.
Thank you. Any questions for Elizabeth Martin Mahal? Yes, Senator Church.
Elizabeth, this sounds like we're trying to encourage the very thing that we almost watched nightly on television, us blowing these massive high-rise government housing structures to the ground and start it all over again.
Senator Byer, you
Senator
just
Byer.
For that to take place, Senator, we would first have to have massive structures like that, and I don't believe we have any of that.
Yes, yeah, I know, but that's what I'm saying. Why would we duplicate something that has been proven not to work? And I think the experience in Portland will show that you can create the most unaffordable housing that's possible by taking action like this.
Mr.
Senator Byron, you may.
Senator, I think my perception is that we have a land use policy dating back to 1973 for compact urban growth. We have a transportation policy that's probably close to 10 years old to try and shorten trips and all of that, and not much of an incentive to help people do that. We have some very good projects in the number of areas in the state, but probably the most of them are in the Portland metro area, and they have to do mainly around transit lines. I go back, we had a core area housing, which this really tags on to, dating about 10, that's probably more than that, 15 years. We amended that. I introduced legislation in the mid-90s to do that along the bus and rail corridors to try and encourage that, just from the logic of that if you go up a couple stories above that. It's actually the European model, if you will. Along commercial strips, you do commercial on the bottom floor and have a couple stories of housing above it, which I think works very well. I don't think this probably talks to large multi-story buildings. It could, but my mindset is mainly that you're talking about 2 and 3 stories, really trying to encourage people to put a story or two of residential on top of some commercial.
Senator Byer, let me ask you a couple questions. In downtown Salem, for instance, and this is hardly in connection with a light rail, but in downtown Salem there are several older structures that are retail commercial on the first floor, and then 2 or 3 floors above, and in several instances they're not currently being used for anything but storage. In some of the buildings there would be a small office space, in other of the buildings there's looks like the potential for redevelopment, but it's for some reason simply hasn't
conversion
caught on. You know, it just hasn't caught on, the conversion, or maybe there hasn't been the proper incentive, or perhaps the owner of the building has held the building for such a long time and their basis is so low in that building that their capital gains bite is so high they can't really afford to convert it because they'd pay most of the gain away in capital gains taxes. How would this bill affect a 3 or 4 story building in an urban center like downtown Salem, for instance?
I don't know that. You're talking about conversion. I don't know whether...
Well, it seems to me that if it had multiple floors and it could be converted to housing units and there was a request from the county or the city, then this designation could be applied, even if it were not to construct new residential housing, but to refit existing residential. So what I'm hoping is that there's some incentive to redevelop downtown cores, even if they're not on a light rail line.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Mr. Senator Byer.
To be very clear, my intent here was not to have the state mandate anything.
Right.
It was intending to be permissive. And in fact, when I worked with LC at the start, I would have preferred that they not have to come to the state at all to get the authority to do this, to just grant local governments that discretionary authority. Unfortunately, that can't happen.
Hey, we don't give tax
under our construction, so they have to apply. So there has to be a mother may I in it. But really, it's their choice, and I assume that people who are elected in those jurisdictions can make that cost. And in my sense, besides for whether it's a social issue or not, the real issue is dollars and cents. It just makes sense to me that the taxpaying public saves money to the extent that it has to invest in fewer miles of sewer and water lines, fewer fire engines because they don't have to go as far, and fewer police officers to the extent that that works because it's more concentrated. There's obviously a point of diminishing returns on there and only create too much urban population. But that's the idea.
Okay. And Senator Barr, I think there are only two buildings in John Day that have a second story.
However, the city has some unusually large multi-story
buildings. Well, as a matter of fact, there is a building, a couple buildings in Baker City that could probably fit the model. If you look at page 1, section 3, line 9, the vertical housing development could be the construction, reconstruction, or rehabilitation of a building, so long as it has multiple floors and that it has retail space on the bottom floor. So it seems to me that there's an opportunity for developing some housing. Senator, if you don't mind, I'm going to call forward some people that have some real problems with this bill and have them tell us what the problems with the bill is. So if I could bring Steve Bozak and Hatsina Squires up, and I think these folks have a different perspective, followed by Janet Young from the city of Beaverton, who has every reason to want this bill to go through, and then we'll talk to Doris Penwell from Economic and Community Development to explain some of the mechanics of how this could work. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning, Senator Ferraroli and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I am Stephen Bozak, and I'm here on behalf of the Tualatin Hills Parks and Recreation District. And the Tualatin Hills Parks and Recreation District serves 200,000 residents serving Beaverton and unincorporated areas of eastern Washington County. And with the exception of Senator Starr, who represents the western area of the Park District in the Alloa area, you probably aren't familiar with the city of Beaverton and our community. But in reading...
Actually, I've had a... in the last session, didn't we approve... red light cameras to go into the city of Beaverton?
Yes, you did.
Yes. Well, I heard
excuse me if I don't thank you.
I heard a lot of commentary from the folks in the city of Beaverton.
Thank you. You don't have to read too far into Senate Bill 763 or use your imagination to realize that this legislation can be directly applied to the Round in Beaverton. And the Round, unfortunately, is a very good example of a public-private partnership gone bad. We're very much in support of public-private partnerships, but this has not been the best project, and this bill appears to be structured around helping that project get out of trouble. Senate Bill 763 proposes to give cities and counties, with the concurrence of right now the State Economic and Community Development Department.
Can I go back a little bit?
Yes.
What is the problem with the round?
I'm not an expert on it, but it went bankrupt a few years ago, I believe the developer did. And since then, there have been a lot of attempts to bring it back and to resume construction. It's about maybe half built. It's kind of a skeleton of a light rail transit town center area. It's just sitting, rusting right along the light rail station, and they're trying to revive it and get it built and finished.
What's been the impact on the Park and Rec District from that?
No impact at present because there's no one living there. It's right downtown Beaverton, and there hasn't been an impact.
What would be the impact if it was completed?
If it was completed without Senate Bill 763 would be additional tax revenues, property tax revenues, and also increased demand on our facilities and services.
Okay.
A lot of people in one small area.
Senator Church?
you can go anywhere in this country and you'll find that wherever you have housing next to a railroad track, it is depressed. And I was there taking pictures of that structure a couple of years ago, which now is beginning to resemble some sort of artwork with all this rust and everything. It's an amazing thing to visit, particularly where a lot of state dollars were put in there to, as far as road construction and stuff like that, to facilitate it. The interesting thing is, you saw me walk over and pick up a phone, and I called a friend of mine in Portland who had done some counts. And the interesting thing is this, that when you go in the area of any transit, you'll find about 5.4% of the people are using mass transit. But when you go into those housing structures that we participated in building along the light rail, they found that 5% less were actually using mass transit. So when we start off in Section 3 by having legislative findings, these are just a false statement. We cannot have those findings in Section 3.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Byron.
Senator, have you heard of the Pearl District? 500,000 a unit for a bare wall doesn't strike me as depressed.
Well, we can, if we were, let's take a look right now. We have a train that's running up and down the corridor. It's costing a subsidy of $51.67 for every person that gets on that train and comes to Salem, for example, and $51.67 when they go home. And for us to have a finding that this is efficient, it's just, I find, very amazing.
Actually, I think, Senator George, your comment is well made. It's an open question for a lot of Oregonians whether mass transit on all applications does what it's touted to do. But I am familiar with the Pearl District. I toured it with some folks from the city of Portland recently and looked at some high-rise opportunities they have, and it's thriving, obviously. So obviously in some places where there's enough of a urban density to make a community, it works pretty well. I don't know if you can make it happen just by putting in light rail and building structures on the theory if we build it, they'll come.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
if you remember a couple of weeks ago, I walked around with a highlighted headline out of the Oregonian, I believe it was, saying that in the core area of Portland, there's been a reduction in population. That headline said it all.
Thank you. Actually, the question that you brought then is similar, the idea that there might be depressed values, there might be unfinished projects, and I guess I just needed to have a little more detail on what the round was all about. Yeah. Other comments?
Yes, thank you. The bill proposes to give cities and counties and a state agency the authority to preempt the collection of property taxes. This authority is proposed without consultation with the affected special districts, especially THPRD. It also affects Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, Unified Sewerage Agency, the Tualatin Valley Water District, and a number of other public agencies in our community that I don't know if they were consulted or not, but I know the Park District wasn't. And frankly, without an exemption in our ability to consult and to endorse the exemption of our property taxes, we can't support this bill. In reference to some statement that Senator George made, Section 3 of the bill talks about cost efficiencies of service deliveries, enhancements, livability, and economic well-being that would be improved through Senate Bill 763. Please understand that those warm and fuzzy words don't apply to the Parks and Recreation service delivery end of things. As I stated earlier, there are going to be more people in a smaller area which will need parks and recreation services. Yes, you may be able to come down from your loft apartment and get a cup of coffee at Starbucks and a pastry, step next door and get a Stephen King's novel, get a sandwich at the deli, go back upstairs and sit in your little room, look out the window and read and eat and do those things. But frankly, I'm not sure that the quality of life will be improved when these folks finish their lunch and their book and they want to go outside and exercise or run or play tennis or use one of our basketball facilities or swim or whatever. Provisions for those kinds of quality of life opportunities are not being provided in these high density light rail transit areas. And it puts a greater burden on the park district to acquire additional parkland, to build recreation, aquatic centers, tennis courts, all the things that folks like to do in the outdoors and indoors to exercise and to improve their quality of life. It hurts us because we lose tax revenue if Senate Bill 763 goes through as it's currently proposed, without our ability to opt out of the tax exemption. Now, I want to give you a good example of a light rail transit area, though, that you might want to consider, and that's Orenco Station. Senator Starr, I'm probably familiar with that. That's a really good example of a vertical high-density housing area with commercial retail near a light rail station. But, you know, that had the advantage of starting from square one, where they built and they planned in a wonderful park and open space, a common area that's a jewel to that little community. I don't believe that's part of the equation at the round. I believe there will be some open space, but it won't be adequate. It won't be anything like a Orenco Station. And with that said, I would encourage, ask that you amend the bill. We are in favor of the -2 amendment, which exempts special districts, and we would appreciate your support in that. And if I can answer any question, I'd be glad to.
Questions for the committee? Senator Minnis.
Isn't your, the bill's permissive and it's predicated upon the city or county choosing to exempt property tax. Isn't your beef in the city or county? Don't you work in concert with those folks when it comes time to look at these kind of proposals?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, the bill is permissive in the sense that it allows a city or county to create this property tax exemption. Mm-hmm. The bill as written does not authorize authorize the consultation with a special district and then the city to determine
The question is, don't you already consult with him? To do what these amendments would purport to do is an additional grant of authority to special districts that they don't currently have. The assumption we have in law is that the cities and counties have the authority to make these decisions, and my assumption is that they dialogue with y'all, because parks and recreation are important components, and I assume the cities and counties had some role to play in the creation of these special districts. Washington County, where they have law enforcement districts, they played a significant role in doing that in order to get property tax revenue or revenues coming into that particular function. So it seems to me that where you have those managers in cities and counties, they, in terms of lineage of authority, they have a higher authority than special districts. So they should have the power to do this if the legislature approves the bill. But what you're asking us to do is something that's really a departure from our prior history in terms of grants of authority to special districts.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, that's absolutely correct. As the current enterprise zone statute works, in administrative rule, it requires the consultation in the application process of the enterprise zone with a special district. However, nothing in that consultation process allows a special district to it allows a special district to express they don't want their property taxes preempted, but nothing in current statute allows a county to say or a city to say, we hear your concern, therefore we will not exempt your property taxes.
Right, but Mr. Chairman, what your amendment purports to do is to allow you to usurp the vision or the plan that the county has or the cities have.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I guess I don't see it as usurping the city or county authority. I think I see it as leveling the playing field, so to speak, because the city or county is being granted the authority to preempt our property taxes.
No, I disagree with you. Cities and counties have a higher authority than special.
Actually, I think the senator's onto something here. There is a dynamic tension between the higher density and the need for recreation and other small district services, fire, police, et cetera. Just at the time when you work to get your tax base sufficient to support, for instance, the Parks and Recreation District, densification would put a great burden on providing those services, and at the same time there's less revenue. But I think that the good senator from Gresham is absolutely right. There has to be an overall vision, and somehow we have to make these things fit. And despite the Mr. Bozak's Kafkaesque presentation of urban zombies drugged into submission by the international conspiracy between Starbucks and Barnes and Noble. I don't think those people are living that kind of a existence. But one of the biggest problems we've got in the urban area is affordable housing, and going vertical is a lot better than going horizontal in that regard. and somebody's got to have a handle on the master plan. Is, you know, is there a way not to overturn the relationship between special districts and the jurisdiction that might request this special designation? I mean, how do we get these people together so that they don't disempower the community's special districts, but they empower the community's need for affordable housing? How do we do
that? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think a way to do that is Senator Byers' vision for this bill is that it be permissive, that it not be a mandate. And I think allowing each local government who's affected by the property tax exemption, say, for instance, not just a city or a county, having the vision preempting the property taxes, any affected taxing district, choosing to be a part of that vision and creating the vertical housing zone, so you would have the city or the county and the park district, the fire district, all saying, yes, we want to create this zone, yes, we want to forego our property tax revenue.
What's the rate of your taxation per thousand for your district?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't recall at the moment. I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
Can you give me an idea about just a gut on the percentage of small districts versus the county or the city?
No, sir, I can't.
Is it like a tenth, or is it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's my understanding from conversations with the city of Beaverton's lobbyists that the total amount of property tax based on a percentage in this type of area would be about a 20%. 20% for special districts.
And 80% for the major jurisdictions. Senator Barr, you had a question.
Senator Minnis's line of questioning intrigued me. One of the things I recognize from being around here is that each area of the state does things differently. And under our land use system, you're required as part of developing a community comprehensive plan to have an element, public facilities element, and I believe a park element. I know in my community, we have a special district that runs parks also, but they actually, for the city, develop the parks element of the public facilities, and they consulted. They are very intimately involved with the city in developing the entire land use plan and all these kinds of things for the area. Is that different in Beaverton Hillsborough area?
No, sir, it's not. We're the Parks and Recreation Service provider for the city of Beaverton and some areas of Washington County. That is not different. We do communicate at times and work together on things. And I'd like to clarify that we aren't against the vertical housing, and that what we're opposed to, we're part of making that a success, and we believe in the livability of the community. We believe that we can have a better community through better transit and these transit centers and bringing these people to these areas. But for us to participate and to help to make that a success, we can't give up our property tax revenues, because we need to use those funds to buy the parks, to build the facilities, to do the things we need to do to complement that kind of development, okay? If y'all can understand that, that's what we're saying here. That's barely what we're saying.
Senator Minnis, and then I'm going to bring the other witnesses forward.
I just wanted to say, in my mind, in the creation of the lineage of authority, terms of the creation of government entities, special districts are not equal to cities, and they are not equal to counties. And therefore, to grant this particular exception, I think, would be impermissible in my mind. But the question I have for you is, assuming that the bill was law and that there was a 40% exemption of property taxes within the district, and assume countywide, let's assume that, your reduction in revenue would be a pro rata share of that 40% reduction, correct? And they're not going to pick your special district tax and say, well, we're not going to pay that, but we're going to pay everybody else. It's a pro rata share across the board.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, yes, everybody loses.
Right, so you lose 40% of whatever it is you're currently getting from, okay.
That's correct, Senator
Minnis. Right, so it's already equal in terms of the pro rata distribution of taxes remaining.
I guess the other thing is that at some point in time, and yes, Mrs. Squires, you may have a moment to summarize, but if the, you know, along with Senator Minnis' commentary, I think at some point in time, the special districts, if they are in fact hit financial extremity because of the pressure put on their service base by an increase in population, the whole community is going to have to respond, and those cases have to be made to the public. And the folks that will have to make those cases are the elected public officials in cities and counties and special service districts. So I see the impulse away from the erosion of revenue, but I also see, as Senator Minnis does, there's a forum for that, and that's the local community that asks for the taxing district would do so in consideration of the fact that they know they're giving up revenue. The city's going to give it up, the county's going to give it up, and the special districts under this construct would do that. Your summary, please, and then let's move to the next panel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on behalf of the Special Districts Association, Hacina Squires, a couple of points that I'd like to make about the way the bill is written. There's no limit on the number of vertical housing zones via that enterprise zone process that can be created. Typically, when we see a piece of legislation coming forward that proposes to allow the creation of new types of enterprise zones, there's a limit on the number that can be created. And I would really encourage you to read Section 3 of the bill, encouraging the use of mass transit via the property tax exemption method. Is that appropriate policy? These are just questions that we'd like to raise. Encouraging and promoting cost efficiencies in the delivery of mass transit. Is that appropriate to do that via the property tax exemption method? Promoting livability in core urban and light rail areas via property tax exemption. I'd also like to point out that this legislation would also preempt school districts' property taxing authority, and I know the city of Beaverton School District just recently passed a large levy, so it's not just special districts that this would affect. And I think Mr. Bozak was absolutely on target with the Orenco Station example. It works. The system currently works. It can work, and we just don't believe that there should be an incentive via the property tax.
Okay, but how about the hollow-eyed urban zombie thing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that sounded actually really good to me. Enter Gladstone, Oak Grove area, I could go for some downtown excitement.
You brought some amendments to this bill. Would you like to briefly discuss the amendment that you'd like to see stuffed in this bill?
Yes. our amendment, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our amendments are the Dash 2 amendments, which would say for purposes of this act, any taxes imposed by local taxing districts listed in ORS 198 are not exempt for purposes of this legislation. And then the Dash 3 amendment is legislation modeled around the current administrative rule that exists for the Enterprise Zone program that requires consultation with special districts and at least provides an opportunity to comment, and that would codify that in statute for purposes of this bill only.
And so the Dash 2 is essentially everything that you'd want to protect the small districts from erosion of their tax base. The Dash 3 amendments would be a medium between the protection. At least it makes it a statutory mandate that the jurisdictions actually coordinate with each other, sit down, talk these things through.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
Thank you. Can we bring forward, please, someone who actually likes this bill, Janet Young, City of Beaverton.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ma'am.
Hello, Senator Ferrioli and Senators. I'm Janet Young, the Economic Development Manager for the City of Beaverton. And I will tell you that it is a coincidence that I'm here today, and it really has nothing to do with the RAM. Not a coincidence that we support this bill, but that our comments in support of this bill are really separate from the RAM. I can answer questions about that if you have some. I have some limited information on that. But my comments here today are really separate from that project that we are in the middle of downtown, which is, you understand, is in bankruptcy. The City of Beaverton supports passage of Senate Bill 763, which would create the opportunity for a city or county to request one of these vertical housing zones. We believe that it would create an additional tool that would allow any city or county to request this sort of a vertical housing district adjacent to light rail or major bus corridors. It would give the opportunity to apply through the state Economic and Community Development Department. We also have heard there is a possibility that that could be through the Housing and Community Services Department. We have no opinion about which state agency it goes through. That's perfectly fine, not a problem. We believe that the simplicity of this bill, that the way the vertical housing zones are set up, and the process that someone would go through to utilize this are real advantages to this proposal, that it's very easy to use, and we think would make it more likely for a developer to use. In the core area of Beaverton near light rail, housing has to be done at a more dense, in fact, all development has to be more dense than in other places of the city. And we do that in order to take advantage of the large public investment that's gone in light rail and other major transit improvements that have occurred downtown. Our city residents are supportive of that dense development downtown, recognizing that that means the people moving to town aren't going to be scattered throughout town. They are going to be, to a large degree, based on the increased density that's coming into town, those are going to be areas that are in our major transit corridors, including downtown, and our citizens have been supportive of that. This type of development is more expensive to build than a typical suburban garden-style apartment. Our requirements in the core area typically mean that the floor area ratios are higher, and you would commonly have to install structured parking to put in one of these kinds of developments. And when we see those being built anyplace around the region or the state, they are typically done with some sort of public incentive. These developments are very difficult to make financially feasible, and public incentives are a common part of these mixed-use, dense developments adjacent to transit corridors. Since by charter, Beaverton has neither an urban renewal agency nor a housing authority, we have very few tools available to us to encourage this sort of dense development. We would anticipate using this tool very sparingly and on a targeted basis. We support the Dash 1 amendment to clarify a city or county's authority to participate in this sort of a development if it meets the purposes of the development. Without an urban renewal agency or housing authority, it is not otherwise clear that a city or county has this sort of authority. We would oppose the Dash 2 amendment of the Special Districts Association. As was mentioned, at least within the city of Beaverton area, the special districts taxes make up approximately 22% of the taxes, and that was not counting the Unified Sewerage Agency, if they really qualify as a special district, I wasn't sure. So if you did include them in, it could be potentially higher than that. We believe that if you erode an incentive to that degree, you've made it much less likely that a developer is going to take advantage of it and would be likely to use it. In terms of the Dash 3 amendment, we would have no trouble coordinating with the other taxing jurisdictions. That is, that's perfectly fine. We believe we have a solid relationship with the special districts in the area and would have no problem with that sort of coordination. The Dash 4 amendment, it was either 9, 10, or 11 years. If believing that it's someplace in that neck of the woods, we would be supportive of that. That's not such a long period of time that we'd be losing revenue for a very long time, but we believe it would make a sufficient incentive for someone to take advantage of this sort of a proposal. I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Any questions for the witness? No questions. And actually, then we have one other person signed up for the testimony on this bill who is neutral on the bill. So we bring forward Doris Penwell from Economic and Community Development.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doris Penwell from the Economic and Community Development Department. The department has had conversations with Senator Beyer, the sponsor of the bill, and with the Department of Housing and Community Services about how this sort of a function might be handled within state government. First of all, I'd like to say, and I'll talk a little bit about where those discussions have led, but first of all, I'd like to say that I just want to note that this bill does not amend the Enterprise Zone Statute. It creates a separate mechanism for exemption of property taxes. So any changes you might make within this kind of an incentive program would be different and separate from the Enterprise Zone program that we administer from the department now. And the department has administered that program for a number of years. When we looked over this bill, we thought there were some positives and possibly negative elements to it, but it certainly is an incentive that might be helpful in certain areas around the state, and local governments, indeed, as you've heard from the previous testimony, might consider such a mechanism. However, you might just consider, and this is not a definite attitude from our Economic Development Department, but it is, you might consider that you could designate the Department of Housing and Community Services to do the same function that is spelled out in this bill. However, I think the department, if the Housing and Community Services Department were here, they would join me, I think, to discuss how this might work. Our agency currently does the Enterprise Zone program and are used to operating such a program. Housing has not been in that ballgame for forever. They do have a natural constituency with private developers and other associations around the state that have great incentives to developing a low-income housing or housing near rail stations, et cetera. And they have other mechanisms within their department that they already operate with. So there are several things you might do with the bill if you move forward with it. And I apologize that we don't have amendments that you might use, but you might consider this either here or if the bill goes to the other side of the building. You might designate the Housing and Community Services Department to do this program, but also somehow establish a mechanism where they could consult with the Economic and Community Development Department in developing the program and implementing it so that there is some discussion among the two agencies about how either one of these programs might work together. And I don't, in the current bill, I don't see a mechanism for doing that because it doesn't necessarily set up a, there isn't any section in here that actually sets up a mechanism to develop, it doesn't limit very much how the criteria would be established. So there might be another section in this bill that you would add that kind of adds that element to it.
Ms. Pennell, I guess I would suggest that we either pick the Housing and Community Development Organization as the entity.
Because
of its tight connection, close connection with housing, or leave the bill as drafted with the Economic and Community Development Department, but to try to ask the two agencies to coordinate with each other on some approach invites, you know, an exponential growth of paper flow between the two agencies, and that is not in the best interest of incenting anything. I think that it causes too much of a swirl in the bureaucracy. So, Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, when I was working on this, actually, I hadn't specifically thought of one of the departments or the other. The drafter came up with that one because that's who does it now for Enterprise Zones and other ones, is Economic Development. I've had discussions both with Ms. Pendle as well as with Bob Repine about this. He asked the very question, why them and not us? And I have thought of it. You want to do it? And he said, well, actually, Mr. Scott and I have discussed it, and it really doesn't make a difference which one. We'll consult either way. But I think either way, it could go either way.
And the only other thing that causes me any questions, that there is a lack of limitation in the number of times or the amount of times the tax credits might be used, but I guess it's sort of self-limiting because the agencies, the cities and the counties that request it, would obviously not push themselves off a cliff on revenue.
Yeah.
So, Senator Beyer, that's the only concerns I have about that. Ms. Pennell, do you have any other testimony to offer?
No, Mr. Chair, I think that's fine. We'll work with you in however way you want to do this.
We have some other folks that wish to come forward and testify. If there's any other person here present who wishes to offer testimony on Senate Bill 763, let them come forward, please.
For the record, my name is Lynn Parton from Housing and Community Services Department, and she said if somebody from Housing were here, they would probably tell you. So I wasn't planning on testifying, but I just wanted to confirm that we think this is a good idea. We would be happy to have it at Economic Development. We would be happy to have it at our shop. We would be willing to coordinate. So whatever you guys want to do is fine. Thanks.
Ms. Parton, you, that was the appropriate amount of reticence. You don't want to appear to have it.
Chair Ferrioli, we're fine, as I said, with it either way. We do think it's a good idea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ma'am.
Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee, I did not plan on testifying, but I did hear some of the earlier testimony.
We got a sign up in the street here.
my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the Vice President of the Board of the Salem Area Transit District Chariots, and we just did a $32 million development in downtown Salem in connection with the county. And when we were looking, before we started building, but we were well into the project, we did a tour of some of the transit-related development in Portland, both on the light rail line and on the Belmont Dairy property on a mass transit line. And there are examples of how this development works right in Oregon. If you go to California and you pick up the condominium and the apartment listing, they'll tell you which light rail line the unit is right next to. These are not necessarily low-income housing. A lot of times it can be mixed housing and market-rate housing. So just wanted to let you know that because of the prior testimony.
Thank you. Any questions for this witness? And you are with the chair?
I'm vice president of the board. I'm a minor little elected official.
Can you
a special district elected.
Yes.
A special district. Yes.
Is there anything you can do about that bell? I mean, I live very close by that. That bell just drove me.
Oh, okay. Well,
we'll talk about that later.
We tried to get it early. I'll talk to the general manager.
Colleagues, we have one of those kind of clear choice issues here. The question is whether to move the bill, and the issue is that either we add the consideration for the special districts to have them consulted on these changes, or we add the amendment that would actually make it impossible for the local jurisdiction to do the tax credit as they had planned to do it, and instead only do 80% or somewhat less than that. And I guess I'll just ask the committee if they have any preference on that issue. Senator Byer, do you have since you brought the bill?
I obviously thought it was a great idea, or I wouldn't have the bill here.
Yes.
I think it's consistent with the state policy and of what we've been trying to do, and it actually just plain makes sense to give. And again, this is not something the state is doing. This is a tool that we would be allowing cities and counties to use within their development plans. We provide them with the mandate that they're supposed to reduce vehicle traffic. They're supposed to plan for public facilities. They're supposed to try and keep schools open rather than closed and inner ones and outside. So we provide the mandates, but they don't have all the tools. This is just an attempt to give them a tool. They may use it, they may not. My suspect is that it wouldn't be greatly used, and there's probably not a lot of places, but there's some that make sense to do this. Looking at the different amendments that are out there, I feel very comfortable with the dash ones, which are City of Beaverton's amendment helps them. I don't like the dash two amendments. I think the dash three amendments make good sense, and regarding the years, we were trying to get to 10,
yes.
So I guess the appropriate number there would have been 9.
And do you have a preference, Senator, about the economic and community development versus housing and community services?
I personally do not. The only, as I was talking with Mr. Repine about it, the only reason we were leaning towards the economic development department is they have the process and they have the staff in place to do it in consultation with housing. It would be something new that housing would have to, but I really don't have a preference one way or the other.
Senator? Ditto. Senator Minnis?
Well, I'm generally supportive. I do have a bit of a concern similar to Senator George with respect to the findings section.
Mm-hmm. Would you support a striking the first whole sentence of the findings?
Well, yeah, I guess I think it would be better off by not having the findings section there and simply enacting the authority rather than the broader policy statement, because I don't know what it really adds to what we're attempting to do, and it may be more controversial than not, so that's just a suggestion, and just
As a senator, I think your suggestion is well made. I have similar concerns with some of the findings. The findings add literally nothing except editorializing to the bill.
And I think it creates some criticism that may be warranted, because there's, you know, you obviously get criticism anytime you do mass transit because of the subsidization issues and so on and so forth. And I've seen it in East County, where I was a critic early on of the East Side Light Rail, but then watched its development. And I've got to admit, I'm fairly impressed by what it's brought to East Multnomah County. And then I had a business over in the Washington County area before Renko Station was built, watched the West Side Light Rail be built. I've seen a Renko Station come in, and I think there's some good planning and development going on in this area. Now, whether I agree or disagree with the density issues in terms of urbanization, that's a big, broad question about, or, you know, urban growth boundaries, and I don't want to get into it, but I think to the extent that cities and counties are participating in that discussion and they're trying to develop these kind of things, who am I to say they shouldn't do it? I think that to the extent that they have good planning and they're working together, it's a good thing.
I'd be supportive, Mr. Chair, of taking it off.
And I guess I would have to say that light rail discussions are a tough sell in downtown John Day. You get me. But doing something for Beaverton and the other urban areas of the state, I think, is an important thing to do. I squawk a lot about the urban-rural divide, and perhaps it's time for me to do something individually to try to bridge that. Senator Castillo, any comments on the bill?
I support Senator Byers' position on the bill.
Another ditto.
Ditto.
Okay. Let's go into work session on Senate Bill 673. Senator Beyer, you seem to have the...
Well, let's just take them one at a time, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move the Dash 1 amendment.
Senator Beyer moves the Dash 1 amendment. Is there any question on the motion? No questions. Are there any objections to the motion?
Okay, not this time. I'll just raise the question of deleting.
No objections to the motion. So ordered. Senator Beyer?
Move the Dash 3 amendment.
Dash 3 amendments are moved. Any questions on the motion? Any objections to the motion? Senator?
I'm going to object to the adoption of the Dash 3 amendment.
Oh.
I don't think that. I think you've got sufficient votes for it. I just don't like codifying in statute. I think they can do it by administrative rule, and I just don't want to go that level. But.
Okay. So the question has been called. Is there any further discussion on the Dash 3? Senator Minnis points that it could be made in administrative rule. I think the testimony earlier was that without something in statute, the small districts feel completely unprotected. So the chair will vote for that amendment. Any other discussion? Hearing and seeing none, let's call the roll on the Dash 3 adoption.
Aye.
No.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Dash 3s are adopted.
Mr. Chair, then on the Dash 4 amendment, I want to be clear, and I guess this is it's not really conceptual. It was just an error. The number, the years that we're looking for, there's 9. So to the extent that we can... Just call that a correction.
Senator Beyer moves the conceptual amendment to change the
Dash 4
amendments. It's on line 1 on page 3 to the 10 would be Mount 9. Is that completely understood?
It'd be clear then, Elizabeth, but that makes it a 10-year exemption?
Or a total of 10-year exemption.
Senator Beyer, that's correct.
Any questions on the motion? Any objections to the motion? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
This is, I would move that Section 3 of the bill, lines 16 through 26 on page 1, be deleted.
Senator Beyer moves that lines 16 through 26 on page 1 are the entire Section 3 of the bill be eliminated and the sections renumbered. Senator Minnis?
I just want to make sure that Senator Beyer is... incorporating, there's a section of the Dash 1 amendment that amends the Section 3 amendment. I want to make sure that that's
the intent.
That's going to.
So that's, okay. You want that deleted too? That's correct?
Yes, we have that.
You want it deleted too.
All right, so then the Dash 1 amendments, lines 3 through 7, are also deleted. Is everybody clear on that?
Rectamundo.
Yeah, that's fine. I just don't know if you have to amend the...
I would amend it into the bill. So.
Okay.
Senator Byer, restate your motion, please.
The intent, Mr. Chair, and I guess this will be conceptual, is to remove what is Section 3, making the corresponding adjustments in the other amendments. That takes the purpose statement, if you will, out. That's the intent.
Okay, and that we have to make sure that we are coordinating with the Dash 3 amendments and not confusing the, the drafters of legislation. So the Dash 3 amendments, which we've moved.
The Dash 1 is what you have to coordinate with.
You just need conforming amendments.
Conforming amendments.
Well, the Dash 3 amendments also have references to the findings.
The intent would be just to conform it.
All right, so the intent would be to conform Dash 3s with the elimination of Section 3 of the bill. And Senator Byer will coordinate with the Legislative Council to make sure that that is done in the appropriate manner. So does everybody understand the motion that Senator George were eliminating those findings and facts? Let's ask for any objections to the motion. Motion is understood. No objections, so order.
Mr. Bill. Damn it.
Mr. Bill.
I'll move it. No. Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 763 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
The motion is to move 763 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions to the motion? Any objections to the motion?
Mr. Chairman, I have the Oregonian, Wednesday, April 25th, 2001. It talks about planners tend to locate development near mass transit. They have some quotes in here. I hope everyone will get the article from Ken Duker, from Portland State University, from Randall O'Toole, from Cascade Policy, talking about the fact that markets are what makes these decisions and that people will vote with their feet and that this is really, in fact, just a subsidy for, you know, mass transit. And so with that, I will obviously be a no vote.
So noted. Let's call the roll on this one, please.
Aye.
Motion passes. Senator Byer will carry. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 763. Thank you. Colleagues, the next bill on our agenda is Senate Bill 333. Good morning, Mr. Waters. How are you today? You will remind the committee about our history with Senate Bill 333.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 333 extends the Farm Worker Housing Construction Credit and the Farm Worker Housing Lenders Credit. Under current law, both credits are set to expire at the end of this year. We had a hearing on this bill, public hearing, back on February 7th. And at that time, it was expressed that there was a need to bring some changes forward. And I think we have those changes today in the form of the Dash 3 amendments. Dash 3 amendments allow a taxpayer to elect to receive an equal property tax voucher for use as payment against local property taxes in lieu of the farm worker housing income tax credit. The Dash 3 amendments allow state that the election is available for new certifications at the time the credit is claimed for the first time by the taxpayer. In addition, the Dash 3 amendments appropriate $100,000 to the Department of Revenue for the purpose of redeeming these property tax vouchers.
Has anybody signed up to testify on Senate Bill 333, we've got it scheduled for a work session only, so I guess there would be no sign-up sheet, unless there is someone here that would like to bring, brought forward to do too far harmony in support of this bill.
We just voted out.
Excuse me, sir?
Can we just vote it out?
We could. If, I'll give the witnesses a chance to testify or to watch the bill move
depends
forward.
Depends on how long they talk.
You have your choice. You can watch the bill move forward, or you can testify and delay the bill.
I just need to make sure that Senator Minnis is talking about the Dash 3 amendments, if they have the Dash 3 amendments in them.
And for the record, your name is?
I'm John McCulley, representing the Tree Fruit.
Mr. McCulley has expressed a skeptical note about the performance of Senator Minnis.
That would not be unusual, is it? Yes.
He is, in fact, referring to the bill as it would be amended.
And far be it for me, Mr. Chair, to stand in his way.
And I'm sure he'll remind you of that on other bills that come before this body.
Mr. Chairman, Don Schellenberg, Oregon Farm Bureau. What Mr. McCulley said
goes for the Farm Bureau.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties, we appreciate the sensitivity that the Dash 3 brings to the issue of the property tax. The property tax has been rolled back, cut, and capped, and yet it still provides the principal source of revenue for essential local services. The Dash 3 amendments attempt to protect the property tax revenues by providing a funding mechanism through the income tax. But the property tax is exempt. The property tax exemption applies in any event, whether it's funded or not. And just want you to understand that effectively what you're doing is granting a new property tax exemption. We've learned, we are learning since 1999 that when a series of statutes was adopted in ORS Chapter 306, which provided that the state would fund 50% of the cost of new property tax exemptions for general local governments, that that policy is made in effect by an account that was created. The account is empty, and we see no interest in ways and means to provide any money for that account. This provides the identical mechanism, creates a new account, says the state shall fund, but if the state doesn't provide the money, then the property tax exemption is in effect. So whatever you do with this bill, Dash 3, understand that we will consider this a brand new property tax exemption and treat it as such.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Breyer.
Question, Gil. Gil, considering the subject of this, which is to try and help provide housing for farm workers in low income, it's very difficult to do. My sense is the fact that you do this probably reduces human service costs the counties that otherwise would be there. So this does have a positive financial impact on counties.
Chair, Senator Beyer, there's no question about the positive effects of this. What I'm addressing is a situation where you have income tax revenues over $4 billion a year, property tax revenues, which are now capped, have been cut at $2.8 billion. Used to exceed the income tax, no longer does. 40% of that goes to the state effectively for school funding. So we're talking about a limited resource which is still critical to the delivery of essential public services. So a decision that you make with respect to a new property tax exemption, what you're saying is local governments shall divert a portion of their general fund revenues that provide essential services for everybody and effectively take it and apply it to this specific function. And we're telling you to do that, and you shall do that. And just so that you know that that's, in effect, what the Dash 3 amendments do.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate you helping us understand what the potential impact could be to the local governments. And I guess that I would also just like to point out that I know that the people who will be, that this housing would be developed for
also contribute to those communities financially through the work that they do to help the agricultural industry be prosperous and successful in our state, and therefore helping to provide the property taxes that do exist in those communities. And it has just been such a struggle, and I do understand what you're saying. I know that local governments are struggling with the current limits that we have on our local property taxes now. But this is a shared program. The state will also be contributing state dollars in this as well. We're not putting the burden all on local governments to do this. It's a shared effort here, because we also are offering tax credits from state dollars as another part of the program. And so I understand what you're saying, and I guess I would say that the state is also, you know, putting in some money into the program to try and get at this issue and see if we can do a better job of providing housing, very badly needed housing in this area.
Sure, Senator Castillo, I appreciate your point, too.
Let's call Senator Miss.
I just want to say, I think Gil is right, but, you know, because I think we need to know for the record that this should not be viewed as a bill that solves the problem. Mm-hmm. And I agree. I think that to a large extent, I think as the state, we have a significant role to play in trying to find mechanisms to meet the needs of farm worker housing, other than just, you know, some simple mechanism like this that puts it on the backs of the counties or whomever else. I think that we have a larger interest in this, and we ought to be focusing on doing something. So, Gil, you know, the Association of Oregon Counties and others, it would be nice next session to have some kind of a proposal in here that is innovative and helps us, you know, develop something that really meets somebody's needs. It's going to require some leadership, and not just a bunch of, you know, happy talk, so to speak. Leadership, some appropriations, some innovative thinking.
Senator Minister, I think it brings up an excellent point. Again, the other thing I think we do need to consider is that the previous bill, we talked about the cross purposes of small special districts in large jurisdictions and the cost of providing incentives to do some of the social purposes that we need to have done. And housing is certainly an issue that fits that category. Senator Castillo and I served for 2 years on the Migrant Housing Task Force, and the needs are critical, they're real, they're immediate. This is a long time coming. It's the right step in the right direction. The best part of this is that it actually comes, the recommendations here come from a coalition of migrant workers and community leaders and elected public officials, and this is the culmination of a long process, and I want to see this thing move forward. Mm-hmm. So let's do move it forward, but we do have a consideration that we must bring forth from the Department of Revenue. So we'll ask Deborah Buchanan to come up and explain how a administration of this may cause some concerns at the Department of Revenue and what must be done to solve that concern.
Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, I think it's really a policy question. As you may know, under existing law, ORS 293.250, the department is authorized to offset the state income tax refund that's owed to a taxpayer against other state debt that that person owes.
Right.
The question is simply whether you would want to extend that policy to these vouchers so that the department, instead of issuing a voucher, would be able to reduce that other state debts before issuing any balance.
Mr. Chairman, isn't that policy, wouldn't that be by implication extended automatically to this program? Or do we have to specifically tie the policy of the state not to provide a tax refund to an individual who, in fact, has an obligation outstanding to the State Department of Revenue?
Mr. Chair, I'm not an attorney, and legislative counsel could probably answer that more definitely for you, but I believe since it's not actually a state income tax refund, it is a credit that they would otherwise be allowed that we're issuing a voucher for. I would question whether or not the existing law would allow us to do that.
Senator Nunes?
Well, I would object to adding that policy to this bill, because it seems to me that the objective is to try to provide incentive to improve migrant farm worker housing, et cetera, and so forth. So if you have someone who has a particular, you know, obligation to the Department of Revenue but still operating an agricultural interest, and what we do is we grant them the credit, but then we take it back again and say, you know, nanner, 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 you owe us, it doesn't do anything for the folks that are out there working in there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I would just clarify that it wouldn't be a debt owed to the Department of Revenue necessarily. It could be another state agency, school loans, court fees.
Right, whatever. I guess the point I'm trying to make is the incentive doesn't go to the, you know, the objective that we're trying to achieve here. So.
Senator Minnis, I guess my that's an excellent argument. It hadn't occurred to me, but it is a great argument. I guess what I would say to Ms. Buchanan is that we're under some obligation to move our bills forward by the 27th of this month, and I would like to see this bill move forward. If there is a compelling interest in the public policy discussion, then it needs to be explicit. I think we'll give our good colleague on the House side, Chairman of the House Revenue Committee, an opportunity to have that discussion, and if necessary, they can amend the public policy into the bill on the other side. And that also gives Senator Minnis and others in this committee an opportunity to discuss that issue in a conference committee if they do modify that bill. So I'd like to go to work session on the bill without objections and move the bill forward. So let us enter into work session on Senate Bill 333. Chairman will entertain a motion for the dash 3 amendment.
Chair?
Vice Chair.
Move the dash 3.
The motion is for the movement of dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 333. Any objections to the motion? Questions on the motion? No questions? No objections? So ordered. And colleagues, before you make your motion, it does have a subsequent request for referral to Ways and Means, like all of our tax credit and expenditure bills, and it does contain an appropriation. So, Senator, your motion, please.
My motion, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 333 as amended to Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation.
The motion is to move Senate Bill 333 as amended to Ways and Means. Any questions on the motion? Any objections to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, it is so ordered. That bill is referred out to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. 6 months is back.
Pardon me? Oh, actually, colleagues, I have made many references and many statements that Senate Bill 61 and no other bill affecting the Senate revenue consideration of school funding formulas would move until Senate Bill 260 is behind it. So we will reschedule that bill for the future. Senate Bill 61 will not be heard today. Senate Bill 935. Let us bring up the appropriate staff person. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair.
How are you?
Very good. Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue.
Mr. Yates, we have had a couple work sessions scheduled for this bill and had some testimony. Perhaps you could bring the committee up to speed on where we are.
We did discuss the bill on April 16th. This bill deals with OLCC and its relationship with the agents that sell retail distilled spirits. The bill requires that the rate of compensation for the agents be set by a negotiating team comprised of, OLCC on one side and members of the agents on the other. It indexes the rates of return once they're established, and has a blank in the bill in terms of future negotiations, how often this group should meet to renegotiate the terms of the agreement. It also appoints a task force, which has a challenging task of looking overall at how we can deal with the issue, find a reasonable way of determining this compensation, or a way of getting OLCL essentially out of the business of wholesale distribution of distilled liquors. Now, my understanding, we do have a blank in the bill. My understanding is that we are awaiting and have not yet received amendments. So I'm not sure what we can do.
Let us discuss some of those possible amendments so that the chair of the committee understands what may be coming at it in terms of amendments. Senator Beyer, did you have a question?
No.
Senator Minnis, did you have?
Well, we were just handed a document from Senator Nelson's office, kind of speaking in terms of objectives of potentially privatizing this organization, whatever else. I don't know how that relates to what we're doing, but if it does, I'm all for it. I think that's probably a good proposal to look at. The one objection I have to this bill, and I have amendments being drafted, is the constraint on police powers in Section 3 dealing with minor decoy operations. So as long as that remains in the bill, I have some problem with this particular.
And, Senator, I understand you're bringing an amendment that would allow the minor decoy operations to continue.
Yes, I do. I will. I'm having it drafted, yes.
Question?
Yes,
What are the amendments that are coming forward?
Well, obviously, Senator Minnis just indicated he would have them.
Putting that back.
Right. And let me ask for to have the representative of the distillers, if they wish to come forward. I think there's some amendments that are being drafted. Is that correct, Mr. Cosgrove?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States. DISCUS does not have a position on privatization. We operate in 18 control states and 32 open states. But when those issues are discussed, we like to have a place at the table. And there is a -1 amendment that has been drafted that just simply adds two more representatives to this task force, that being a representative of an in-state distillery. We have several in this state, the largest being Hood River Distillery, and a representative of out-of-state or other distilleries. That's all the amendment does, is just add two more members to that task force. I'm sorry, I don't have the bill in front of me. I left it behind me. I can't remember which section of the bill has the task force, but it's...
Mr. Crosgrove, I think just the purpose of our orientation today is just to let committee members know what amendments may be coming forward.
Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And are we anticipating the arrival of those amendments in time for the hearing?
They are drafted, and I thought there was one in the committee file. If that's not true, I will correct that immediately.
Okay. They, I think, are still forthcoming. Yes, Senator Beyer.
So are we down to looking at just the establishment of the task force?
I think, Senator Beyer, we are looking at actually trying to specify some kind of a compensation. I think what also has been discussed would be the creation of an indexing mechanism, the negotiating team formation, and the request for proposals on the sale of the, or at least the distribution process being taken outside of the state control. The bill as drafted has a lot of language about privatization, which the chairman will bring amendments to strike. There's no intention to privatize the OLCC at this time, but there is an intention to request a study to be done and even a request for proposals to change the distribution method from the state warehouse. And right now we offer or operate a pretty extensive warehousing operation, and I'm not sure at least that that's in the best interest of the state. If there's other models out there, I've been told that potential operators of a distribution system would not be interested. I would like the opportunity to test that theory, to see if there is anybody out there that could operate the warehouse and distribution facility on a completely market-based and private system. So I'd like to try to see what interest there is out there. What that means is requesting a Department of Administrative Services or other state agency to offer a request for proposals to operate a warehouse, or from the distiller's representatives or any of the other distributors of alcoholic beverages, if they would be able to take over distribution rather than the state maintaining a relatively expensive and extensive warehouse facility. Now, I guess I will call your attention and others to the report that you were given. It's covered with a sheet from Senator Nelson's office. What it really is a rather excellent study done by David Clyburn, a legal intern to the Senate Majority Office, about Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the enabling legislation that created OLCC, the factual background of OLCC, relationships with OLCC agents and perspectives on privatization, and addended to that is some of the Michigan liquor control codes that have changed the operations in Michigan. MLCC is virtually identical to OLCC in every way. They have gone to a modified privatization. That's possibly a model that would inform our discussions. And then after that, there is an award-winning report that was done by the Oregon Retail Liquor Association. It was one of 10 winning reports in the 1994 Oregon Better government competition, and it has some specific recommendations about how OLCC could be improved. And it makes a fascinating read, and there are some implications for the bill that we are considering. So I would recommend that to the committee as background reference before we have our work session on 30. It seems like a lot of reading, but it's a fast read. So those are at least some of the amendments that would be coming forward to the committee. I see some representatives of agents here. Is there anything that you would like to bring before the committee before we move on? Please come forward.
Chairman and other senators, my name is John Hurl. I'm a liquor agent from Lincoln City. I spoke to you before you about this. And I wanted to just state that the agents really do support this bill. And basically all of its contents, especially the task force part, to look into future modifications that might benefit the state and OLCC and how it's run. The biggest amendment we would like to see, if we could, is in Section 2, where it says we can negotiate between OLCC and ourselves for our income. We'd like that, if we could, amend it to where it says it becomes a cost of doing business. Because right now we have no say in our pay. I would like to correct Pam Erickson, who spoke last time and said that right now an agent can go before OLCC and negotiate their pay, and there nothing like that exists. Right now it is set at a certain percentage, like 8.54, and that's what it is, and you get a percentage of that. Like my store is like 6%. It's a sliding scale. There is no negotiations allowed, and the only chance we have is we go before the Ways and Means Committee, which I appeared at the last few weeks, and asked for slight increases. The Ways and Means Committee has stated they're going to keep it the same as it is. So that means for 6 years, we have not got a pay increase of any kind, and also OLCC adapted that we will now start picking up a share of the credit card cost of selling the state's liquor, and we will also be paying for our own bags, which at a store my size, which I'm just about in the middle of the state size-wise, will mean I'll be losing about $4,000 a year out of my net income to offset these costs with no chance of recouping any of these costs. And so all we really want to see is where we can sit down and negotiate with OLCC that we at least keep up with the cost of living and we don't actually keep going backwards, because in 6 years, cost of living has gone up, all our costs, rent, insurance, minimum wage has skyrocketed, and it's really cut into what we're making. So all we're asking for is a fair chance and be able to compensate for this. And part of this bill says that every year they do look at the cost of living index for an increase. So we're not asking to go out and go from 8.5% up to 10 or 15 or 20. We just want to be able to stay ahead of the cost of doing business so we can keep doing a good job for the state of Oregon. Any questions?
Senator Byer?
Just an opinion question. It's off the top of my head. I'm just curious, since you're here. What would you think about the state just getting completely out of the business of liquor, moving the enforcement to the state police and replacing the sales income with just an equivalent tax, licensing anybody who wanted to sell it?
Senator, briefly, my background, I mentioned before, I had two liquor stores in California for about 14 years, and I've been a state agent here for 12. And if you really do believe, which personally I do, you really do believe in the principle to keep liquor out of minors' hands, intoxicated people, this system works 10 times better than what I experienced in California. And for the majority of the agents, we would rather not ever see it go into privatize. We think the basis of the system, where it's structured, is great. We think there's, with any government agency, there's some waste at the top that we think that maybe this committee could look into that would be formed to save this. But it really does, the way it's being done, I think really does handle it. Just when you compare distilled spirits to the sales of beer and problems they're having there with minors getting their hands on it and the availability.
Wouldn't you rather buy, have the option to buy directly from the distillers or...
Senator, I looked at the Michigan plan, the Iowa plan, and did some, like what I had dealt with, because I bought directly from distilleries in California. The idea of, I think, OLCC controlling the price of it, the outlets, and other controls like that, but the idea of possibly doing away with the warehouse and buying directly from the distillery reps and the state only paying for the liquor
once it arrived at my store, I think that would benefit the state enormously, and I would estimate several, like $4 to $5 million a year continuously, saving the state that. It would make more products available to the consumer, and it would allow us to run our stores at, I think, a little better level.
Bit of a mess.
Yeah, I won't belabor this, but does OLCC have some income assumptions for their agents? What do they assume you're going to make as in terms of your personal income as a liquor agent?
They, Senator, they base our income on projected sales, mm-hmm. and then they use that percentage mm-hmm. on that sale.
So what does that mean?
Well, usually, Senator, if we go to the OLCC and as a group and we say we need to make more money to cover these costs, they said, well, we project sales are going to go up. And I passed out last time with several sheets. You probably have tons of paperwork, but it shows that most of the projected sales increases in the last 6 years have been concentrated on 25 stores, and they are in the metropolitan area, like Portland, Bend, and your large...
But if I was going to be a liquor agent, how much money would I make?
Senator, that can vary from a small store. If you work it every day yourself, I had the store in Prineville for 3 years, and I worked it 6 days a week, opening and closing, and I would, after costs, I was netting about $32,000 a year. Out of that $32,000, I also had to pay my home retirement and my health insurance. And then at the store I'm at right now in Lincoln City, I would estimate that I'm probably netting about $60,000 a year. And out of that, I have to pay that about $20,000 for the benefits that would normally be paid if I was a state employee.
Okay. So do you freely share that information with OLCC when you're negotiating those kind of issues?
Yes, Senator. In fact, I left it in my briefcase. We have a booklet about this thick that was just produced in 1999, and it gets down to the penny, everything, all our costs, even janitorial fees and everything. And my particular store shows that my net income has dropped $14,000 a year over the last 5 years because of my rent has doubled and so on. And we present this, and our answer this year from OLCC was, well, then now you're going to pay for bags and your cost of credit cards, and kind of if you don't like it, there's the street. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm a big OLCC supporter. I have a name for that for the last 12 years, but I do believe in fair play if possible.
Momentarily, Senator George, I noticed that Representative Morissette has joined us, and if he would care to make comment or any other way elucidate this committee, and then Senator George has the floor. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I served on an interim committee on agency oversight during this last interim, and we heard testimony from the OLCC and the agents concerning some problems that either side felt were there.
Representative?
Yes.
You know that
I'm sorry, Representative Bill Morris.
There's a adoring public out there that's tuned into the internet right now.
Representative Bill Morris.
Identifying list.
Set District 42, Springfield. Thank you. I apologize.
Thank you.
As a member of the agency oversight committee, I was interested in helping to resolve some of the problems that the agents came to our committee with. We heard testimony from Pam Erickson, the director of the agency, and from Phil Lang, who was the chair of the board. I met with them. I met with the agents. I was asked by Chair Loken to be the point person on this issue for that committee. I did attend a Seaside conference, as did Senator Ferrioli, and during the summer to again, here are some of the concerns. I made a report to the committee. The committee suggested that some work be done during the early part of this session. Senator Ferrioli and I have continued to meet with both sides. We did visit the warehouse, and which raised some interesting questions about the state of Oregon and our distribution system of whether or not that's the right way to go. We're in the process right now of having some hearings to air some of the differences. This is has been going on for the last several sessions and cannot be solved at one time, but we feel, we meaning Senator Farioli and I and some of the representatives from the agents, that some changes should be made. It's an archaic system. It's ruled, the underlying principle is temperance, but the overlaying principle is make more money for the state, and included in that is if we're going to have a shortfall, we're going to have to cut back on what the agents are receiving. And I think that's what you're hearing today, and I think that's patently unfair. I think the agents are small business persons. They should be treated like small business persons. There should be greater flexibility. I guess either they're employees or they're truly independent contractors and not treated like independent contractors at the present time. So we're looking at some equitable solutions to this. The OLCC does have a place. I don't want to see the OLCC to go away. I think they have to continue their oversight, but I think there needs to be a better system of dealing with the people who are on the front line. So with that, I'll stop. There's a lot of information that we have been gathering, and as these hearings continue, we will present more information. Thank you.
Representative, this really boils down to relationships, doesn't it, between the agency and the agents?
It does, and of the 240 agents, there are three distinct categories. There are a relatively small group who want to become independent licensees. There is another group that feels that there is absolutely no problem at all with the OLCC. These tend to be smaller rural agents. There's a middle group, and I think John represents this, he does not want to become a licensed independent person, but he does recognize the inequities in the system, and I think we're in that middle group. Although I don't have a problem with independent licensees, that where they are privately running their business, they buy the business, and when the time comes, they can sell the business, and as any other small business person can, and what you're selling is the goodwill that you build up over a period of time. That's the one thing they can't sell right now. There's a limit to what they can be compensated for their business, for the 20 or 30 years they've put into it. So I think they ought to be treated like the small businessmen that they really are, but to preserve some of the things that I think the people of Oregon want to preserve in the system that we have. I do not want to turn it over to the grocery chains to handle spirits. I don't think we want to go that far, but it is a relationship issue, yes.
Thank you, Representative Merced. Questions for the representative? Any? Thank you. Senator?
Yes.
Yes.
Question?
Yes.
We were presented with an analysis of a comparison, particularly of Michigan, with the decisions they made relative to where Oregon is. And I'd like to read a couple of quotes to you guys from this and then kind of get a response. I'll ask that question at the end. First quote, privatization creates less of a state influence in distribution and tends to streamline operations. Okay? Privatization will also confer a major financial benefit on liquor stores, as the Michigan evidence suggests, actually suggested, and I put back the other page, about $6 million additional dollars profit to the dealers. Then this quote, evidence from Michigan tends to support the conclusion that the state will be rewarded with financial benefits if privatization is done. Tell me your response to those quotes.
To
Both of them, yeah.
Either one wanted to comment. Okay. Senator, there is a chance if it's privatized that an agent could make more money. I work on 6% right now. In California, I worked on 22%. But to get the 22% in a private market, I'd have to take it out of the general fund rather than pass it on to the consumer, because I think that'd be unfair to the consumer.
Because of our high level of taxation that we have compared to California.
Right.
Yeah, we're at, what, about 105% markup on?
Right. Okay. And I think this task force looking into where we might be able to privatize a section of it, still keep the control, and without where we actually, we wouldn't reap a lot of money, but we could at least continue our status of living, if you know what I'm saying. I think that's kind of a blend of both worlds, in my opinion. I just see too much when I was in California, when you can make 22%, you get into cutting prices, big sales, you really start pushing the product more. Like I say, I like the controlled atmosphere here myself.
Senator Ferriola, Chair Ferriola, Senator George, we are looking at various options from other states. Michigan is a model that we've looked at, and I think it does present some interesting options of some privatization. I'd like to look at the distribution system, and I don't know if you've talked about that yet, but I think that's something else that could be done, handled differently. That could be privatized, the distribution system could be, and the state could still make the rules and keep the controls, and the thing I like, I guess, is the opportunity for people to become businessmen, truly independent, and that is part of the Michigan model without completely destroying what we have. And I think we have to do this incrementally. We have to make a few changes and see how they work, and then can move on to the next set of changes.
I think the constant thing that we heard was just the trauma of change. Michigan went through a single step, and they made their change. They basically studied the thing for a while, many years, as a matter of fact, and then enacted the Michigan reforms, and it was quite disruptive. The state had a significant decrease in income. The agent's income fell off. It was quite a traumatic experience for some folks. I think maybe the situation in Michigan has stabilized, and now they're looking at a long-term trend of increased income to agents and a significant increase of revenue to the state. And those side benefits have been... the state's got no liability now for operating liquor stores, which currently the state does have. And there is more choice in the marketplace for products. The state has no cost associated with distribution of the product that gets the revenue. The state still has the authority over the product, still can control who has access to it, but doesn't have the superstructure sort of looming over the agency folks as they do in the current model in Oregon. The political issue is whether or not there's the energy in the state of Oregon to make a one-step change, and I don't think there is. I think Oregonians may be ready for a little bit of change in this regard, but I'm not sure they're ready to walk into Safeway and see two aisles of spirits being sold right along next to the beer and wine. So, you know, those are the questions, right?
Right next to the lottery tickets.
Exactly, and cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
So, colleagues, we've kind of beat this horse a little bit, but the fact is I think this is a fascinating area that we might actually be able to improve on our current system. But let's talk about that tomorrow, and we hope that all the amendments will be done by that time. If they're not, we'll have to do this again next week. Any questions from the panel for the committee? Hearing and seeing none, we'll close the public hearing, our work session on Senate Bill 935, and we are in adjournment for the day. Thank you, colleagues.